It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says Sheryl Sandberg's call to women to lean in is the wrong way to go. We'll find out why.
But first, it's Sunshine Week, a national initiative to make the case for more open and transparent government.
Here in Wisconsin, state law authorizes the attorney general and local district attorneys to use court action to enforce open government laws. But according to our next guest, Attorney General J.V. Van Hollen has never pursued such court action during his time in office.
Eric Litke is a reporter with the Gannett, Wisconsin investigative team. He's produced a two-part series that examines the shortcomings of Wisconsin laws on government public records and open meetings. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, is this just a journalist problem, or should the public in general be worried about open meetings and open records laws?
Absolutely. I mean, the short answer is that open government is better government. Public officials, whether elected or appointed, are more likely to make decisions that are in the best interest of the citizens if they know citizens are paying attention. Open records are a key way that citizens and journalists alike can kind of look behind the curtain. See whether government is operating efficiently, ethically, and in the best interest of the people who are paying for it. Open meetings laws are kind of in the same vein. They're supposed to make sure that discussions and decisions by public officials are happening out in public. The question that we addressed in our series is basically whether these public records and open meetings laws are being properly enforced. Open government laws are all well and good, but their value drops dramatically. There's no repercussions for ignoring the law.
And what you've tracked in your series in large part is a lack of citations issued for violations of open government laws. What kind of violations are out there that you're referring to?
Sure. We basically went through online court records over the last 5 years and looked for any citations that were issued for violations of open meetings or public records law. We found a total of 7 citations. 17 others were filed but later dismissed. So over a 5-year span across 72 counties, 7 different citations for violating open meetings laws, none for violating public records laws. And we talked to prosecutors, and some say, well, that's because either the laws are generally being followed or because they're using these situations, these violations, as kind of a teachable moment to say, well, here's what you should have done and here's how to do it next time, as opposed to issuing a citation. But the other way to look at that is that some of these complaints are falling on deaf ears. We talked to a couple folks, a lady in Sheboygan County and a woman in Appleton, who had taken complaints to a local district attorney saying, here's what I think is a violation of open meetings law or public records law. What can you do about it? And they were essentially ignored, had to go file court action on their own, spend thousands of dollars and more than a year in court. And in both cases, they were ultimately successful in establishing that the law was being violated.
Well, from the Attorney General's perspective, could it be just a matter of priorities? They've got bigger things, more pressing things on their plate, and something has to fall by the wayside?
Well, state law basically provides 2 different enforcement options here. District attorneys in each county can pursue these, or the Attorney General can't. J.B. Van Hollen, throughout his time in office, has just made it a matter of policy to say he's going to defer to local district attorneys. Peg Lautenschlager had taken action a couple times to enforce open government laws, but Van Hollen, who was not willing to talk to me on this particularly, but his office has sent out letters to the hundreds of folks that have questions on open meetings or open government, and they consistently say that it's a matter of policy and resources for the AG's office. So basically, yeah, they're saying that their priorities and their manpower needs to be headed elsewhere. DAs will say the same thing. You know, when we asked a few, you know, how some of these may have fallen through the cracks, basically, you know, when you put an open government complaint up against a serious felony case, they're saying they're short-staffed and they've got to make decisions as to what they pursue.
And these aren't cases that come up all the time. A DA's office in a county might or a city might be ready to deal with that felony you mentioned. Are they trained? Are they familiar with how to approach an open records or open meeting violation?
It certainly seems like that's something that varies a lot by county. One of the better setups among the folks that I talked to was out of Winnebago County. They have a particular prosecutor that is tasked with dealing with these, and he's gone through some specialized training on open records and open meetings law, and they also have a part-time investigator who has some special training on this. Other DAs that I talked to acknowledge that it's not an area of the law that they're real familiar with. They may, in many cases, get one or two complaints a year at most on things like this. And when those do come up, there'd be a lot of research that has to take place to say, okay, well, what does the law actually say? Is this a violation? How do you go about enforcing it? Because they're very nuanced laws.
So if I'm a citizen, I'm trying to raise one of these complaints, I'm not getting any help from my local DA or from the Attorney General's office, maybe I don't have the money to pursue things with private lawsuits, do I have any recourse at that point?
If you don't have the money or the desire to pursue it in court yourself, you're pretty much in a tough spot. There certainly is a way to pursue that in court on your own. For like a public records request denied, you can seek a writ of mandamus that would have a judge order that certain records be released. That's something that could theoretically be done on your own. But typically, this is something where it's a matter of getting attorneys involved. There is recourse at the end of it. The lady we profiled out of Sheboygan County, as part of a settlement agreement, was able to get all of her attorney fees refunded. Lady out of Appleton is still seeking that in court, but state statute does allow that a citizen who's fighting an open government complaint and succeeds can recover the attorney costs. But it is still a matter of fronting that money and hoping to succeed and maybe be able to recover it in the end. But as we have these situations come up, it's putting a lot of responsibility on the citizen to do the enforcement of the law, as opposed to having that be in the hands of the attorney general or of a district attorney.
In reporting on this story, did you just get the sense that local governments were and local government bodies were aware of the open records and open meetings requirements and were just flouting them, knowing nothing bad would happen, or are they just not quite sure how to comply? They don't know that they need to make this meeting open and that meeting not open.
I think the entities that are blatantly trying to hide something from the public are going to certainly be the exception. It's more frequently going to be something that occurs maybe in a smaller township where you have someone who's been elected to office who's not real familiar with how government works. Maybe it's their first term in office. And if there's no mechanism to have gotten them training on what's required to post an agenda that has, adequately descriptive agenda items, what's required if someone files a records request, what should be released, what shouldn't, those are the types of violations that can come up. And so that's the explanation that prosecutors give in saying that, these may be more teachable moments than something where you want to file a citation. The concern potentially comes up, if it's a situation where the DA is not going to get involved at all.
You mentioned those teachable moments, and this is Sunshine Week, maybe another teachable moment. Are local governments starting to get the message about open government?
That's a difficult thing to say. Some of the folks I talked to basically say, you never really know the scope of these types of issues, because in many cases, there's just not enough people that are paying attention, particularly when you get into a smaller municipality. There may be only a handful of people, if any, that are attending a village board meeting or something like that, and they wouldn't necessarily have the training to know a violation when they see it. So it's really a difficult thing to say whether that's something that's better now than it used to be.
And before we let you go, it's Sunshine Week. If someone's listening as a citizen or somebody in a local government elected office, appointed office, where can they go to find out more about Sunshine Week and open government laws?
Sunshine Week website is sunshineweek.org. So that has some general information on kind of what this initiative is in terms of raising awareness. For those interested in Wisconsin open government and open meetings, public records in particular, J.B. Van Hollen's office has produced very extensive rundown of what state statute requires and allows in terms of what types of records are available, what it should cost to get them, how long it should take, what it means to have an open meeting. So those can be viewed on the Attorney General's website.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eric Littke, an investigative reporter for Gannett Wisconsin Media. His two-part series looking at Wisconsin's open government laws in honor of Sunshine Week concludes today. Our next guest was a working mom with a demanding job. She took the advice that Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg gave to women and got busy leaning in. She signed up for extra work assignments, and she leaned into her role as a mom and got busy organizing parties and becoming a room mother. Then the bottom fell out.
Rosa Brooks is with us now to tell us why women should forget Sheryl Sandberg's advice about turbocharging their careers by leaning in. Brooks is a law professor at the Georgetown University Law Center and a columnist at Foreign Policy Magazine, also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Rosa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to get caught up, how would you summarize what Sheryl Sandberg's advice to women means when she urges them to lean in?
You know, I think she means two things, one of which I absolutely agree with, and then one of which I'm much more ambivalent about. The piece that I think is important and good is she reminds women not to self-undermine and do the, oh, gee, I'm sure what I'm about to say is probably wrong, but I'm really sorry for interrupting and even saying it. And, you know, she urges women to not do things like that, to, you know, to have confidence in themselves and their expertise, which is something I think men traditionally have found a little easier than women. And I think that's right and that's important. I'm much more ambivalent about her advice to lean in a way that means doing more. And I think she's frankly ambivalent about that herself. But the nature of the modern workplace has been such that increasingly being a good worker is equated with being a ubiquitous worker who's around or available 24/7. And when you lean into that, it really hurts you, particularly women who usually have a second shift at home of childcare and other household responsibilities.
So when you do all of this leaning in, what is it supposed to get you as a woman, as a worker, as a mom? What is it supposed to net you?
You know, I think the idea, of course, is that we still live in a world in which men outnumber women in leadership positions in almost every aspect of our society, whether it's Fortune 500 companies, senior government and political positions, big law firm, leadership positions, you name it. And women also still earn less than men in comparable positions. And those are real problems. And to the extent that women sort of self-undermine by taking themselves out of the running or undermining their own authority, I think Sheryl Sandberg is absolutely right. But to the extent that the implied solution is to just do more and more, I think that's unworkable. It's unworkable for women. It's unworkable for men. It's bad for workplace productivity. It's bad for the quality of work. And it particularly tends to keep women from succeeding and gaining leadership positions.
So you didn't think that at first. You decided to take Sheryl Sandberg's advice out for a test spin. You work in the field of foreign policy. You're also a mom whose kids have active lives. When did you start to try to take her advice and see what happened when you leaned in?
You know, readers of the column that we're talking about, I think, will know that that was largely tongue-in-cheek. I did not, in fact, ever make a decision to suddenly lean in, in contrast to anything I've been doing in the past. What did happen for me and what motivated me to write that column is that, like many women, I think, I found myself at one of those moments, a moment that I'm sure is familiar to everyone, particularly women and also to some men, one of those moments where I was trying to do 16 things at once. I was actually on an Amtrak train. I was trying to write a column. I was trying to edit a memo. I was trying to email and make phone calls to set up a cast party for my daughter's sixth grade musical. I had slept 3 hours the night before. I was going to race off to a work-related dinner the minute I got to my destination, then get up at 5 a.m. to take an Amtrak train back home again. And I thought, whoa, this is nuts. I'm trying to be perfect at everything and never say no to anything, and this is just crushing me. It's bad for me. It's bad for my work. It's bad for my kids.
So it seems like it should be sort of a girl power moment when you feel like you can do it all. You can juggle those 16 things on 3 hours of sleep, but the result for you and you're guessing for lots of other women is that they get sort of crushed under these loads. So is that the core of what's wrong with lean in, that it's just not sustainable?
Well, I think it doesn't really fundamentally challenge what has happened to the workplace and what has happened to our expectations of parents, and particularly women. And, you know, it's not really fair, obviously. I joke about hating Sheryl Sandberg. I don't really hate her. You know, and it's not really fair to ask her to solve every problem. I think it's just the book has become so iconic for so many people. But I think the fundamental message people take away from it misses something really important, which is that in the last 30 or so years, 30 to 40 years, two things have happened at the same time in American society, and together they're really pernicious, particularly for women. And those two things are that we have shifted to the assumption of 24/7 workplace availability. You know, remember, once upon a time it was a reform to create the 8-hour workday and the 40-hour work week. Today, most Americans, regardless of their income levels, if they're employed, they are working 60, 80, 100-hour work weeks, one way or the other, either because they've got to be at the office, or maybe they come home but they're turning on the BlackBerry, they're right back to the laptop, they're doing conference calls while they're making breakfast in the morning. And we've come to assume that that's what good work is working all the time. At the very same time, we've seen a real shift in our cultural understanding of what makes a parent a good parent. I'm in my 40s. When I was a child, I would come home from school and my mother would say, go out and play. Come back at dinner time. And today, especially for middle and upper middle class kids, we equate good parenting with a parent who's always shepherding their child to supervised play dates, lessons, tutoring, extracurricular activities, which, of course, also just requires an adult to be available to supervise, to chaperone, to drive kids everywhere. And it literally is impossible for one human being to both manage the sort of modern parenting expectations and modern workplace expectations. Men, by and large, aren't expected to try to do both. Men are usually assumed to, you know, if you're a good worker and you see your kids a few times a week at dinner, you're doing a lot better than your father's generation was. But for women, both of those cultures are incredibly demanding and just unsustainable.
Do you think that's widely acknowledged that it is unsustainable for women to do both these, essentially two full-time plus jobs? Or do you think we're still in a place where women are expected to lean in and commit just as much as men if they want to get ahead?
I think that's the trouble, and we haven't yet fully culturally acknowledged how unsustainable this is and how bad it is, not just for individuals, but for the quality of the work we do and the quality of the parenting we provide, quite frankly. You know, and I think that's the one thing I would not want anyone to take away from my column is the idea that this is just a call to lean out and do less or opt out or slack off. It's instead a call to challenge the assumption that more is better. Very often more is worse. Very often doing more and more and more means you're working around the clock, but the memos you write, the things that you produce, the ideas you generate are worse. They're poor quality. You're making bad decisions. You're producing bad stuff. Very often the helicopter parent who's hovering over their child is not only exhausted, stressed out, and their child will pick up on that, but they're teaching children that they can't function independently. You know, and so I think that what we really need to be doing is not so much saying, oh, take a break, take time to smell the roses. That's something that we should do that on an individual level. But there is a broader point here, which is that if we want a society that enables women to be in leadership positions, as well as a society that's just healthier for all of us, men and women and the workplace, we need to push back really hard in a really organized way, both against the intensive parenting culture and its demands and against the assumption that more is always better in the workplace.
So is that going to be a hard thing for women to achieve? Because as you said, it needs to be an organized movement. Everyone needs to do it, probably men included, if
Absolutely.
They want to get traction on this. Because if it's just a few women who are leaning back and saying, whoa, this is too much, they're just going to get passed up and the system will just keep on chugging past them.
No, it is going to be hard, no question about it, because it's got several different dimensions. I mean, there's a piece that we can each do as individuals. There's a piece that we can do collectively in our schools, in our communities, in our workplaces, and there's a long-term piece which involves legislative change, you know, better, more family-friendly laws. And that's going to take a while. That's going to be a heavy lift. But I don't think that it is impossible for each of us to literally start right now. And part of it is just having the personal courage to realize that it really is okay to say at work, I've got to go home at 6. If there's an emergency, let me know. Otherwise, I'll be back at 9, and I'll take care of this work then. And I think many people often have, they and this is not true, obviously, for hourly wage workers who are often extremely vulnerable, but those of us in salaried positions often have much more power than we think we have and a much greater ability than we think we have to push back gently. And I think that when I have tried to do that, when many people I know have tried to do that, usually they're quite astonished that the response is not, oh, you're a bad employee. The response is, oh, good idea. I'll go home too. I'll see you in the morning. And so part of it is just having the personal courage to set reasonable limits. But the other piece of it, and this is still, you know, short of that long-term legislative change.
And we're just about out of time. I'm sorry we don't have time for the end of your sentence, but
no worries.
Rosa,
okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Glad to be here.
We've been talking to Rosa Brooks, a law professor at the Georgetown University Law Center.
We celebrated the 25th anniversary of the creation of the World Wide Web last week by one system of measurement. Happy belated birthday, Internet. While Internet users celebrate contributions the web has brought to our lives over that last quarter century, many are concerned about the growing challenges to the open and free nature of the Internet.
That includes the creator of the Internet as we know it, Tim Berners-Lee, who last week called for an Internet Bill of Rights to protect the freedom of its users. Our next guest echoes that call, and he's here to tell us why he thinks we need to formalize Internet neutrality and privacy, and what the next 25 years might hold for us if that doesn't happen.
Joining us now is Clint Finley. He's a writer for Wired. Clint, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, to understand the concept of a free Internet, we have to kind of go back to the beginning. Can you tell us about Tim Berners-Lee and his original vision for the web?
Sure. The Internet actually existed before what Tim Berners-Lee has built, but What he wanted was a system for linking academic documents together, and the big thing was that he decided to make it a completely open system so that you didn't need to be an academic, you didn't need to be someone associated with a particular institution or a business, and that all of the software for it was free, both in terms of the price, but also in terms of it being something that anybody could use for whatever purpose they wanted. And so that's how we got the web of today, that can be used in so many different ways, far beyond what he ever originally imagined it being used for.
So Berners-Lee had in mind this completely open system. What has happened since then that we now find ourselves in a position where he's saying we need an Internet Bill of Rights?
Well, a couple things. In some countries, you know, China is the most famous example with their great internet firewall of China that does some heavy-handed censorship, blocking, blacklisting certain websites so that people can't access the information that they want to access. There's also a growing concern here in the United States about something called network neutrality, which is the idea that all traffic on the Internet should be treated equally regardless of where it's coming from or going. So for the most recent example, Netflix, which sends quite a bit of traffic through their streaming video service, and whether they should have to pay more than, say, Google pays to send email through the network. So should some companies have to pay more than others? Network neutrality insists everybody, all traffic should be treated the same on the web, on the Internet. But, some companies are starting to question that in modern times.
With this idea of an Internet Bill of Rights, where would that be? We've got a patchwork of international agreements. Individual countries have their own laws. I imagine the United Nations is in there somewhere. Who would maintain and enforce an Internet Bill of Rights?
Yeah, that's an open question. I don't think anyone has a good answer for that yet. It's actually enforcing anything like this would be extremely difficult. It would be really difficult to get countries to really agree on what they want to have be a part of it. You know, in the U.S., the government's faced a lot of criticism over the past few months since Edward Snowden's NSA revelations about the size and scope of the U.S. government's surveillance of the Internet. And I don't think the U.S. is going to be interested in giving that up quite yet. I don't think China is going to be enthused about the idea of giving up their firewall. So actually getting all the big players to the table and actually agreeing on something that's enforceable is a tall order. That said, I think something along the lines of an international trade agreement would probably be the most realistic way of accomplishing something like this, though thus far most of the trade agreements have actually been more on the restrictive side of things, trying to do copyright enforcement that some people think could actually enable censorship. But it is a way of creating some transnational agreements regarding the internet.
Do you think there's enough cohesion around the idea of an open internet, sort of in the vein of what Tim Berners-Lee envisioned, that we could even agree on what would go into that Bill of Rights?
Well, I think in the U.S. and the West, there's pretty broad agreement in terms of what individuals want. The NSA spying is initially people were pretty divided about it, but as time has gone on, as more documents have become public, according to Pew Internet Research, the public sentiment has been generally shifting against the NSA. There was Consumer Reports did a survey that found that consumers overwhelmingly prefer net neutrality. I think it would be harder to say what people in say China or Russia or Egypt, Iran, places like that, what the citizens there would prefer. And then, of course, what governments prefer is an entirely different story altogether.
Since the beginning of the internet, there's been an almost utopian idea of using the internet to bring together the creative power of everyday people. Are you worried if we don't see a movement like this Bill of Rights that people are going to be, I guess, scared off, not wanting to participate in an internet that doesn't match that vision?
I don't know. I think people, creative people, will be excited to use the internet and use technology to collaborate and to create things. It might be harder to find an audience if something like YouTube is more tightly regulated, or if it costs a lot of money to get access to it. Part of what's been exciting about the internet is not just the opportunities for creative people to create things, but for them to actually find an audience through the system. I mean, I'm sure people will continue to use the internet, but what they're able to find and how much it costs them to access things might change significantly.
In a kind of doomsday scenario about what could happen if some modicum of openness and freedom of speech and all of that stuff isn't preserved and protected, what would happen? What is the worst thing that could happen to the internet, say, 20 years down the road?
Well, one possibility is that we would have, instead of having one internet, we would have multiple different internets. So there might be the internet that has Netflix on it and the internet where you can only do email and that sort of thing. I think that's one of the more scary possibilities. One of the great things about the internet thus far is that if you have, no matter who your email provider is, you can send an email to somebody else with a different provider. So if I have Gmail and you have Hotmail, we can send email to each other. In the era of stuff like Facebook, and this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with an Internet Bill of Rights, but a Facebook user can't just send a message to a Twitter user. But this idea could kind of start to go further if we really start to see fracturing of the Internet, where there's different levels of access that different people have. There's a question of whether your traffic could even jump from one internet to another in a situation like that. So people would be much more cut off rather than connected.
this idea of an Internet Bill of Rights is just part of a bigger campaign, I gather, called Web at 25. There's another campaign called The Web We Want, pursuing some similar goals. What can you tell us about these campaigns?
Oh, let's see. Not a whole lot. I haven't been involved in those campaigns. I know The Web We Want is actually trying to get an actual document together that would be an Internet Bill of Rights, and I'm not sure how they would actually try to implement that. But I think they're starting with that first step of what would we actually want in an Internet Bill of Rights. And they've mentioned network neutrality, better guarantees in terms of access to the Internet. It's in a lot of places, high speed Internet or any Internet at all is not yet available or not available at a price that people can afford. So those are some of the things that they're working on right now.
We're talking with Wired magazine writer Clint Finley about why he thinks the Internet needs a Bill of Rights. And we want to hear from you, too. Do you think this is a good idea? Is some sort of Bill of Rights needed to protect Internet freedom? What rights would you include? And what worries you the most about the Internet now? Is it government surveillance, censorship around the world, corporate control, ending net neutrality? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on our Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about protecting the Internet and Internet freedom with Clint Finley, a writer for Wired, and he's echoing the call made by Internet founder Tim Berners-Lee last week, who said what we need is an Internet Bill of Rights. And what do you think? Is this a good idea? Do you think there are things that need to be protected? Are you worried about things like corporate control, net neutrality, free speech limitations? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. And Clint, who would be driving, do you think, a call for a Bill of Rights for the Internet? Would it have to come from the big stakeholders, or would this be coming from the ground up?
I think that it's going to have to come from the ground up. Like I said, a lot of the stakeholders actually are against some of the things that we've been talking about. The United States government doesn't necessarily want an end to surveillance. The Chinese government doesn't necessarily want an end to censorship. The large telecommunications companies don't want to be told that they have to enforce network neutrality if they don't want to. So I do think it's going to have to come from the citizenship.
Are people riled up about this enough? You mentioned the Pew Research showing that people aren't happy with the NSA, but is this just a case where if we get enough kittens online, we'll be happy, we'll be not worried enough to really get out and be activists on an issue like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Consumer Reports survey actually showed that something like 10% of Internet users would actually be willing to stop using the Internet altogether if network neutrality was violated. And the vast majority of them said they would switch to another Internet provider if their Internet provider started treating traffic in different ways. So there's a case to be made that people would be upset by this. I think we haven't reached whatever threshold that is yet.
Let's go to our phones right now. We've got John on the line from Rhinelander. Hi, John.
Hi. We've been using Facebook mostly to organize and fight this the mine they want to build in the Pinokies up here, and it's been pretty effective. Every event that we hold, we put it on video on our page, and then people comment on it right away, and we also get more people up to the camp to participate. It's been real effective, but I am afraid that if the Internet starts getting restricted, they'll just steer it in a corporate way into commercial applications, and we won't have that free platform anymore.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, John. And Clint, let's look at corporate control a little more closely. Is that something that a lot of people, including Tim Berners-Lee, are concerned about, that the corporations who are the big stakeholders in the Internet right now could limit free speech and could limit the ease in which people can talk to each other and communicate?
Yeah, that's it's a big concern right now. on the topic of Facebook, and I don't think, again, this might not fall under the sort of things that they're talking about having as part of the Internet Bill of Rights, but Facebook uses algorithms to determine what actually shows up in your feed. So if you're following some political causes, and you're expecting to see updates from those causes in your feed, if the algorithm for some reason is tuned to not show you those updates, then you're not going to see them. And I think that's the broader issue with all of this stuff, whether it's network neutrality or the open web, is often not that somebody wouldn't be able to put their campaign videos online, but that people won't be able to find them or access them once they've been put up somewhere.
Well, but Twitter and Facebook have been used in protests around the world, tangentially at least in North Africa with the Arab Spring and elsewhere. And there are concerns in a lot of countries that governments are looking to have a kill switch. When there's times of discontent, they can just flip the switch and turn off their citizens' ability to communicate in those ways. How important an issue is that in the next couple of decades?
That's a big deal outside of the U.S. where that's a much more likely scenario. It actually did happen in Egypt, for example, and that definitely is something that would be that would fall under the Internet Bill of Rights idea, is that you would, and that's where I think a trade agreement could actually be an effective thing there. Where if you would tell a government, tell a country that if they shut down the internet, then they're going to face fines or embargoes or something of that nature.
Well, I think a lot of internet activists and hackers, if we can use that phrase here, aren't holding the breath for governments and corporations to do that. Are there things that people are doing, can do, to try to protect at least some of their internet communication rights, their privacy, that sort of thing?
Well, there's a lot of technologies out there, encryption tools that you can use protect your communications. A lot of people are interested in hosting their own websites instead of putting things on Facebook now, because they have more control over things like that. There's only so much, only so far you can go, though, when the networks are actually owned by large corporations or controlled or that are subject to the laws of their nations. But there are things that you can do to route around some of that.
Well, in that same vein, the internet, since its inception, has sort of had this feel of the Wild West, where the rules are being made on the fly and it's very loosely organized. Is an internet bill of rights the wrong way to go because it's going through such mainstream channels? Do we need to be looking at something else? People who believe in this, should they be looking at something that is more subversive and doesn't go through those same channels?
There's a case to be made for that. Actually, another possibility would be what's called mesh networks, wireless mesh networks, that would actually just completely do away with the need to communicate over the expensive internet pipes that are owned by the large telecommunications companies. The problem is that those would be a lot less reliable. You would be dependent on a large enough number of people adopting that platform, and it would be entirely wireless and running from smaller wireless hardware than, say, the big network towers that companies like Verizon own for cell networks. But it is another option.
That would, it sounds like, get around worries over free speech and censorship and maybe corporate control. That sounds like it would probably still be subject to surveillance, surveillable, I guess. Would that be right?
Right. Though if it's also encrypted, then there's only so much that the government can find out. But the flip side of that is there's still only so much you can hide through surveillance. And in a lot of ways, this could end up being a lot like pirate radio or pirate television, where the government could try to crack down on it by figuring out where the signals are coming from and arresting people for operating the equipment. Or they could also try to jam the signals, that sort of thing. So it's not a perfect solution either.
You mentioned earlier that 10% of people said they would be willing to stop using the internet if conditions reached a certain point. Would we ever see such a thing as, I don't know, a worldwide internet strike? And even if there were lots of people who'd be willing to be mobilized, would it matter?
I don't know. It would matter to a company like Facebook or Twitter that is dependent on, you know, getting eyeballs in front of their advertisements. I hadn't thought about the idea of a strike like that, but if it gained enough momentum, you know, it could have an effect. I don't know if enough people would actually be willing to give up the internet. I mean, what people say in a survey isn't necessarily reflective of what they'll actually be willing to do when it comes down to it.
You mentioned earlier some maybe worst cases for the next 20, 25 years. What would your vision be, your maybe not utopian, but your best possible scenario be for the next quarter century of the internet?
I think, honestly, just more of the same would be a pretty optimistic scenario. It would mean that things don't improve in some places, but just if things don't get any worse than they are now, I don't know. That sounds a little bit pessimistic, but things aren't terrible for most people right now. So just maintaining that baseline would be good. With the exception of expanding, I do think access needs to be expanded in rural America, as well as a lot of the rest of the world where people just don't have access. But just maintaining the status quo in general would be, I think even that much would be a victory at this point.
Clint, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Clint Finley. He's a writer at Wired Magazine. We've been talking to him about a call for an internet bill of rights.